A little bit of interest rates today. We will touch on the politics of this economy as well. Also, pie. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 28th of August. Good as always to have you along. Yes, sure, politics got all the glory this week, and honestly, it will for the foreseeable future, and we get that. We don't like it, but we get it. But look, econ-o-me, people, the economy, it matters now and also will for the foreseeable future. Trust me. So here to digest the week that was are Lynette Lopez from Business Insider, also David Gura from MSNBC. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So Lynette, let me start with you, and we're going to start with Jay Powell, the chair of the Fed, gave a big speech, much awaited, one might say, yesterday about the Fed's new thoughts on inflation and how it's going to treat it. They're going to let it run a little higher than they usually have the past couple of years. Here's my question to you. The Fed has not been able to control inflation nigh on these many years. Janet Yellen, I was doing a panel with her one day, and I said, what's up with inflation, and why can't you guys figure it out? She looked at me and gave me that shruggy, I don't know. Why should we, as much as Jay Powell has done for this economy, why is this a big deal?
Jay Powell talking about running inflation hot is like someone saying they want to play at Carnegie Hall when they haven't mastered chopsticks yet. We have not seen inflation since before the financial crisis. This is a handy dandy thing to know when this economy maybe starts chugging along again and people start to wonder, we have a lot of ground to make up. We are still clawing back from very, very dark times in this economy since the coronavirus hit. So I can understand why Jay Powell is saying that once the recovery starts, and only God knows when that will be, we will want to run inflation a little hotter than 2%. But like for now, I'm not exactly sure. That's not really useful for this exact moment.
Yeah. Okay, David, I want to talk a little bit. We talked last week, Catherine Rampell and Sudeep and I did, about the Democratic convention. I want to turn to the Republican convention and the needle that President Trump is trying to thread running on this economy. He is saying, I created the best economy in history, which is, first of all, not true. But second of all, look around because it's demonstrably terrible now. How does he thread that needle of running on the economy when it's in such bad shape?
Through the same means he does a lot of things, which is just to repeat what he hopes is the case over and over again, with the expectation that people are going to buy it. I mean, it was a thing to behold this week. You're right. He talked about the way things were and the way he expects things will be in the future. But it's a blind promise. He expects people to take that at face value. And as you say, there's the rhetoric and there's the reality. And this was the 22nd week out of 23 when more than a million men and women applied for jobless benefits for the first time. The labor market is still in pretty bad shape. Consumer confidence is incredibly low. And so he has no way of talking about that with any nuance. And that includes the history that you're bringing up, the fact that this was an expansion that began years before he came into office. And he has no ability to speak in real terms about what needs to happen. Of course, the pandemic continues to rage on. More than 1,000 people died yesterday on the day on which he accepted his party's nomination. So I think that what he's banking on is just people are going to blindly forget that. If he can just keep talking about what he hopes will be the case, they're going to be able to forget the way things are.
Lynette, do you suppose, and I'm going to trot out a little data here, right? There was a Pew study that came out a couple of weeks ago that said 79% of people think the economy is the most important thing going on right now. My hypothesis, though, developed over, this morning, was that it's entirely possible that we are so polarized that the economy is not going to matter. What do you think?
I think that there are people who were willing to overlook our polarization because the economy was good. There are people that can overlook Trump's lies, as David Gura pointed out, his lack of touch with the with reality, his lack of just any ability to tell the American people the truth or help or care for anyone other than himself or someone in his family. I think that will matter if the economy goes badly. And that is why I think the economy matters, because you can overlook a lot of very unpleasant things when you are living life fairly well. People can tune out the government when they can pay their bills. They can tune out the lies. They can tune out the chaos and dysfunction and the fact that people around them are getting sick. But when they can't take care of their own families, it's a very different situation. And it makes you realize that the person you're dealing with is incompetent.
David, what do you think of that calculation that really it's the economy plus, right?
It's the economy plus. I mean, as I listened to the president last night as he delivered his speech, I was struck by how much he was going into the realm of the counterfactual, the way things would be now if Joe Biden had been president. I think that's going to be a increasingly big problem for this president. I mean, a lot of people were pointing out over the course of this convention as he talked about security, as he talked about the economy. This is a thing that he owns. He has been president for almost 4 years now. And I think people aren't going to forget the fact that he's been the one leading the country at this point. And then I think what I found the most perplexing and in a way the most disturbing was how he applied that counterfactual to the future. He talked a lot about what Joe Biden's America was going to look at. And the way that he forecasts that or foresees that is by ginning up something that really isn't there. And you saw this kind of emphasis on socialism, even an emphasis on communism over the course of this 4 day convention. Again, it just seems so divorced from reality. And there isn't engagement with sort of the way things are or the way things are being talked about by his opponent.
My favorite is, what have you got to lose? His old slogan. Yeah. What do you say to people? What have you got to lose? Well,
the oldie, but the goodie. Lynette Lopez, you can read her on Business Insider. David Gura, you can catch him at MSNBC. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Enjoy your weekend. On Wall Street today, things are a little bouncy, a little choppy. All to the upside, though, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We got another quick snapshot of this economy today, and hold on a minute, because here's a word. We got to look at what this recovery looks like, because lots is bad, as we pointed out 2 minutes ago. But as we said on this program yesterday, there are some parts of this economy that are looking all right. From the good people at the Bureau of Economic Analysis over at the Commerce Department, we learned personal spending was up in July 1.9% from the June number. Also up and unexpectedly were personal incomes, about 0.4% higher in July. That date, July, the timing is important because the end of July is when the extra $600 in unemployment insurance ran dry. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on that one.
According to the Commerce Department, that increase in personal incomes is a sign that more of the economy is starting to reopen. Daniel Kuhn at Columbia Business School points out that personal income has two components.
One is the salary people receive from working. The other one is the social insurance programs. And that part is actually going down.
In other words, less money in unemployment benefits. We'll see the full impact of that when this month's numbers come out. Kim says people who relied on that extra money to pay their bills will feel it, and business owners will too.
But the expiration of the social insurance programs in UI provides them with sort of a demarcation line. It's a good time for me to open my business back up and call people back.
Some recipients will be getting extra benefits again soon by way of funds President Trump is diverting from disaster relief. Veronique DeRuggi is with the Mercatus Center and says people in dozens of states are likely to get that extra $300 per week. A few states are already sending out bigger checks.
Effectively, what it means is for unemployed people who are counting on it, it's just basically a reduction of half of the bonus part, which is not half of the benefits. But so for them, it's going to make a difference.
For as long as that money lasts. Analysts say that might be only a few weeks. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
As schools are opening up in whatever format they have decided works for them, it's not just academics and the coronavirus that local districts are worrying about. Students' mental health is a big concern as well. And as with most things healthcare related, it comes with some costs. Lisa Roth covers mental health for American Public Media.
All summer, Patrick McCauley answered mental health hotline calls from his home.
It's funny, I used to be working on sort of the workbench type thing that's in my garage.
He finally set up a proper desk.
Although I'm sitting on a camp chair, so it's a little makeshift, but it works. It works okay.
McCauley is a social worker with the Los Angeles School District. It set up the hotline shortly after schools closed in the spring. He's one of around 500 counselors for the district, which is the second largest in the country with just under 700,000 students. He works with kids from elementary through high school, and once schools closed, he fielded a variety of calls. He took a call from one mother who called while her daughter, an elementary school student, was having a meltdown.
And she was sort of literally having a tantrum, like she had run in her room and she was throwing some things around.
Students, parents, and others can call the hotline for advice about how to handle an immediate situation or for referrals for therapists. Classes are online this fall, and the district plans to keep the hotline up and running. Other districts have taken different approaches. In Harrisonburg City, Virginia, they set up a virtual relaxation room where students can come watch videos and find tips for dealing with mental health. School will be mostly remote again, and school counselors will be available to sit in on virtual classes. April Howard oversees mental health in the district.
Teachers can refer to say, I'd like the behavioral specialist. You know, I'm having a challenge with this particular student on each time we're on synchronous learning. And the behavioral specialist can be a part of that to give some suggestions.
Administrators in Minneapolis know that many students depend on schools for mental health care. So it's made plans to open school buildings for appointments with counselors with appropriate COVID precautions. Rochelle Cox is an associate superintendent.
What we're planning on is working with some of our community partners and starting to invite them back in to provide some by appointment one-on-one services for students.
She says the district is also looking at reallocating the school budget to hire more mental health professionals this year. It already works with more than 300 mental health professionals for the more than 35,000 students. A lot of districts can't do that, though, especially as school budgets are likely to be cut in response to the COVID-19 economic crisis. That leaves teachers responsible for their students' mental health. Sharon Hoover co-directs the National Center for School Mental Health at the University of Maryland.
So unfortunately, school mental health is chronically underfunded and understaffed. And so a lot does fall on the shoulders of our educators when we don't have the proper student instructional support personnel in place.
Still, she says, it's absolutely critical that kids' mental health gets taken care of now. She points to studies of past disasters, like Hurricane Katrina, which showed that ignoring the trauma had negative effects on academic performance for years after the incident. In the Twin Cities, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If you have a little brother, you should bring them along so they're cute and they attract customers.
That is some sound business advice right there. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 161 on this Friday, 0.5%, 28,653. That means, by the by, the Dow has erased its losses for the year. The NASDAQ found 70 points, 0.6%, 11,695. The S&P 500 picked up 23 points, about 0.6%, 35.08. For the 5 days, the Dow added 2.5%, the NASDAQ gained 3.3%, the S&P 500 up 3.25%. 42 million people are now participating in SNAP benefits, Supplemental Nutrition Program. That's according to some new research out today from the data analytics firm IRI. Uses census figures. Company says about 13% of the population benefits from the nutritional assistance program. That is actually a couple of percentage points more than just in March, which is forever and about 5 months ago. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The clothing retail story this year, we know, right? Bankruptcies and store closures and going out of business signs, mostly. Not all due to the pandemic, but it sure didn't help. Lord & Taylor said this week it's going to liquidate, selling down to the studs at all 38 of its stores and just going away. That, of course, follows the store's bankruptcy filing not too long ago and an unsuccessful search for a buyer. Not the first, won't be the last, but there is an asset left after all the merchandise is gone. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports on what happens to the actual physical stores.
There's this conventional wisdom that one of the most valuable assets a struggling retailer has is its stores, its literal physical locations. But
without a buyer, they're worthless.
Mark A. Cohen is director of retail studies at Columbia Business School. He says it's going to be hard to find a buyer or even a new tenant for Lord & Taylor stores. These spaces are designed to be department stores. They're generally located in malls, and they're huge with multiple floors. And brick-and-mortar retail is flailing.
There is no department store on the face of the earth that I'm aware of that is in anything but consolidation mode, if not in out-and-out failure mode.
Cohen says as more people shift to shopping online, it's possible department stores could be converted to fulfillment centers for Amazon, which is trying to get closer to customers to make same-day shipping easier. But zoning rules might get in the way. Dan Sheridan at the real estate consulting firm The Hoffman Strategy Group says there are other possibilities, too.
Everything from telemedicine uses to general office to multifamily.
He's talking about apartments. There is some of that repurposing going on. It's worth noting here that Lord & Taylor stores are actually owned by two other big names in retail, the mall operator, Simon, and Hudson's Bay, which owns Saks and has a stake in Litote, parent company to Lord & Taylor. Which is just to say, the retail industry is starting to look like a set of dominoes. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
You got your data-based economic indicators, the jobs report and retail sales and gross domestic product. Nice, solid numbers that you can wrap your brain around. And then there are the experiential economic indicators, the things that you feel or that you see or that show up in your email. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
There's a grocery store and wholesaler called Sahadi's in Brooklyn that imports and sells products from the Mediterranean and the Middle East. Pat Whalen runs logistics for the company. Over the last couple months, he says he's been getting a lot of unsolicited emails from trucking companies.
Just randomly, constantly asking for cargo. Do you have anything? Do you have anything? Do you have anything?
Whalen says he's never even heard of these trucking companies.
One, I think, was like two or three times a day.
He says watching his inbox fill up with these emails is troubling.
When you see them constantly coming looking for cargo, that means they're not getting their normal cargo. So what did they lose? What's not shipping?
One answer, food supplies to restaurants. Michael Kucharski is the vice president of JKC Trucking, which operates over 200 refrigerated trucks from the Midwest to the West Coast. Shipping foods to restaurants, hotels, and bars used to make up nearly half of his business. Not anymore.
We're about, 35 to 45% down. And what these truckers are doing is they're searching to haul anything.
Kucharski's company moves products to grocery stores, too. He says there's been an uptick in that, but it hasn't made up for the closed restaurants and bars. So now he's reaching out to potential customers to see if he can drum up any new business.
We're also reaching out saying, hey, where are other truckers failing you? We even negotiated some lower rate to help move it along, too.
When trucking companies are reaching out to find new customers, that may mean they're worried that their old customers might go out of business, says Dale Rogers, a professor of supply chain management at Arizona State University.
There's a lot of uncertainty about who are the companies we're going to work with over the next several months and as this thing ends.
Still, some transportation companies are seeing a rosier picture.
Importers are placing big bets. There's no question imports have surged, especially in the LA basin. Coming in from Asia.
William Villalon is the CEO of APL Logistics, an international supply chain company. He sees signs that other sectors of the economy are recovering too. For instance, auto parts are moving, which is a sign that people will be buying more vehicles.
And you're seeing a spike in forest products because housing starts are up, because demand is up.
But Villalon says the real question is whether that increase in demand is sustainable. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
I wouldn't call it spare time or free time, but the whole work from home thing that so many people are doing and the school on Zoom thing so many kids are doing has upended a lot of people's schedules, and there is often some unscheduled time, let's call it. So if you're a kid who has to figure out how to keep yourself occupied at home, well, the challenges of quarantine can be an opportunity.
Hi, I'm Zach from Alabama, and I'm 12. My business's name is Pie Patch. I sell pies around the neighborhood and deliver them. I was bored, so I started baking. Then I found I really, really had fun with it and liked it. I started my business because I wanted some way to make pies without overflowing us. I always bake the pie on demand. I'd make 10, 15 pie crusts all at once and put them in the freezer. And then the night before I make the pie, I defrost them in the fridge. And then I'll get up in the morning, make my filling for the pie, roll out my crust. For my apple pie, I brush melted butter on top of it and give it a brown sugar rub. An apple pie is $21. Break that down, I have $10 of profit for me. I have $8 for the cost of ingredients, and I have $3 for the pie plate. If they return the pie plate, they get $3 back, so it's really only $18. You need to understand what you're dealing with in advance. I thought, oh, I'm just gonna make pies. Then I found out I have to calculate all the ingredients. I have to see what everyone else is doing, how much homemade pies cost at the farmer's market or stuff like that. Don't just think, oh, to make a lemonade stand, I just have to make lemonade, go out and sell it. No, you have to pay for the lemonade. You have to find an area that has a lot of people and traffic. If you have a little brother, you should bring them along so they're cute and they attract customers. I think it would be fun to be a pastry chef or something like that, but I don't think I want to do the business aspect because when you grow up, you have to buy your own building, you have to get investors, and you have to do so much more than what I'm doing now. I think I'm just going to be a baker if I ever want to go into that type of profession.
That was Zach from Alabama. He's a pie entrepreneur. $10 profit on every unit sold, by the way. That's pretty good. His story comes to us from Million Bazillion. That's Marketplace's new podcast for kids and their families, helping money make more sense. Available, of course, on the podcast app of your choice. This final note on the way out today, with all respect to Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed, here is central bank inflation targeting done right, courtesy of the Bank of Jamaica. When I want it too high, when I want it too low, no, no, no. When inflation's stable and predictable, that's the way to go, car when it high. We don't want it too high. We don't want it too low. That is real, by the way. The BOJ released it yesterday. I personally would pay good money to see Jay Powell do something like that. He plays the guitar, I'm told. All right, we are out of here, but not without a parting moment of economic context on this Friday. And I hate to send you out on a downer, but just as parts of this economy are recovering, as Kimberly was telling us, other parts definitely are not, most specifically the labor market. A glance at the layoffs and furloughs announced just this week proved the point. Coca-Cola, today, 4,000 people. MGM, 18,000 people starting Monday. American Airlines, another 19,000 on October the 1st. That is a lot of jobs, and that's a lot of people, too. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.